Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Alessia Bali, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over 300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is 12 Years a Slave, as part of our Bagels and Books series. We wish to thank our co-sponsors, the Marriott Library, ASUU, and the Daily Utah Chronicle. Today's guest is Janetta Williams. She is president of the NAACP Salt Lake Branch and the NAACP Tri-State Conference of Idaho, Nevada, and Utah. She recently retired from Utah Transit Authority with public relations, and prior to joining UTA, she was employed at U.S. West Communications. Janetta was elected to the NAACP National Board of Directors and served 6 years from 1996 to 2002. She initiated and led the successful effort to change Utah's Human Rights Day to Dr. Martin Luther King Day, Jr. During the 2000 legislative session, Janetta was able to get sponsors and lobbied for passage of the Utah hate crimes and the victim rights bills. She assisted legislators in 2007 with the passage of legislation to change Utah's constitution start day of the legislative session from the third Monday in January to the fourth Monday. Janetta has served on numerous committee groups. She served as a member of the Utah State Bar Ethics and Discipline Committee and co-chair of the Pre-Education Committee of the Utah Task Force on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Legal System, and presently the West Valley City Police Review Board. Please join me in thanking our guest.
Thank you very much, and good morning. The title is very clear, 12 Years a Slave. Now, this book and the movie is based on a true story, as you know, and one that we can all at least kind of relate to and see, you know, what happened in back in those years. It's about Solomon Northam, who was a free man that was sold into slavery by two men, Graham Hamilton and Merle Brown, who he trusted. And that's why I wanted to just kind of bring the movie so you can just kind of see a little bit of it first and to lead you into the next part of what happened, you know, in history and just kind of evaluate that. So this film begins with a group of white folks entertained by a fiddler player and two other black men. So the setting was in 1841 in Saratoga Springs, New York. And within this true story, there was dishonest trust, there was accountability, decisions based on profit-making money, and families that were broken up and sold into slavery. There was never a compromise and no consequences for what Hamilton and Brown had done. And as you saw in the book and the movie, that they did what they did and without any trouble with, you know, with the law or what they did. They just felt that it was their right, and they did. As they said very early in the movie, it said it's very sensitive to the needs of people, is what they said. But they weren't very sensitive to the needs of people. Graham Hamilton and his partner, Merrill Brown, were deceiving, and what a lot of folks would say, low down, and only saw a way to make some fast money. So looking for a new act was how they lured Solomon in, telling him, you could make some good money, and we will take care of everything for you. All of your papers showing you are free. They stopped by Solomon's house claiming he could make a lot of money and that they would be back before his wife returned. So because he was reluctant in even leaving. But so after Solomon agreed to go with them, they made a toast to his success. And as you saw, he wakes up chained in a pit with rats asking where he was, and the voice tells him, we're going to Louisiana to be sold. And this person named Jim Birch, who was a friend of the two people that had lured him into this, comes in, and Solomon recalls Hamilton talking about this man named Birch. And so Birch beats Solomon with a big board and demands that he calls him master. And Solomon didn't want to do that, so he literally just beat him and came back later and put water on him to wake him up and took his wedding ring, and so he never did see that again. So what was amazing was that when Henry Northam and Anne received word by letter from Solomon that he was in Louisiana, they were not able to do anything. This was a while before he was able to get word out by this person that was on this boat with them. And no help from the governor, who had said to Henry that it was not a state matter. So, see, no consequences whatsoever. Then Master Ford was where Solomon ended up at this particular time. And he said he was an older man, and he said he didn't believe in, whipping his slaves. And he would have them come out on Sunday mornings, and they would have church, and he'd read the Bible to them. And so they changed Solomon's name to Plaque. And Master Ford ended up selling Plaque to Epps. And so the white carpenter, Mr. Bass, he had, I'm kind of skipping forward, he had liked Plaque, and he agrees to take a letter to help Henry. And so after 2 months, then Plaque wants to run because nothing has happened, and he hadn't heard anything from anybody, no rescue or whatsoever. And so he wants his freedom back, and he is determined this time to run. And there's an old man named Noah, and so Noah continues to tell Plaque not to run because there's nowhere to go. They'll end up whipping you and then you're bringing you back. And so Plaque does not know that his letter did reach Henry. And Henry tells his wife Anne, Solomon's wife Anne, and the children that he had been found. So when Henry goes to Washington for help, reaching out to a senator, the senator agrees to help and tells Henry that what was done was a violation of the law, but it was a violation of the law, but nothing ever happened to them for doing that. Henry finds Solomon and Plaque, says goodbye to everyone. They tell Plaque not to forget them, and Noah tells him that it's in your hands now, send help. And Plaque promises that he will. But throughout this story, you might have even asked yourself, what would I do or what would I have done, in this situation? Plaque asking this person that he thinks that he can trust to get a letter to his family and to Henry, and not knowing that that person may end up giving the letter back to the master. And, what might be the consequences at that time? And then, if you were Solomon, would you have given up from becoming a free man? Or if you were his wife, Anne, would you have given up on Solomon coming home? The purpose of this book was to tell what happened to Solomon, but Solomon told his story. But we know that there were many more Solomons that never were freed until the 16th President Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, passed by Congress on January 31st, 1865, and ratified on December 6, 1865, the 13th Amendment abolished slavery in the United States. I guess whatever that, I would say whatever that would strike you as, noteworthy. you know, to note all the things that had happened to Plaque at that time. And so I'm not going to make a critical assessment of the book or movie because, you know, it tells the true story of Solomon in a way that we cannot imagine. You know, ships with black men, women, boys and girls brought and bought and were sold at auctions like animals, you know, made to work without pay. So these stories and many others are told, but what seems to be missing is that it is never mentioned or talked about, and that is about reparations. So we hear so much, you know, we've seen different movies, Django's, Roots, you know, all of the different movies in the past, and about slavery and what happened, and, you know, bringing over and the working in the fields, and families being separated. But all of a sudden there was a talk maybe like 3, 4, 5 years ago that talked more about reparations. And but then in the movies, you know, you never hear them say, well, you know, what about reparations? What can be done, and how can we, you know, repay all that free labor? And so Wikipedia describes reparations for slavery as a proposal that some type of compensation should be provided to the descendants of enslaved people in the United States in consideration of the coerced and uncompensated labor their ancestors performed over centuries. So that's been kind of an ongoing battle. Congressman Conyers had sponsored a bill, but like I said, it seems to just kind of die out. They don't know, you know, what it is that people should get, you know, money, land, or compensated some kind of way. And so I know that, you know, the audience here appreciates this true story and what was told about Solomon and how it was told, and it brings a lot of sympathy to, you know, what had happened back in those years. But instead of feeling sympathetic to Solomon, you might ask yourself, what can I do today to make a difference in an effort, you know, to make change in society every day? You know, what it is maybe that you're already doing that can make a huge difference in society and what happens in the lives of so many people every day. Some folks, they become involved with NAACP. Of course, we're the oldest civil rights organization in the country, founded in 1909 by a group of black and white citizens. And we celebrate February 12th, Abraham Lincoln's birthday, and our Founders Day because of all of the work that President Lincoln did to help abolish slavery. You might want to volunteer with voter registration. You know, they have voter registration on different campuses, community events that go on in the community. And remember that often good deeds come with no money. And so when you're doing all of your volunteer work, you're doing it because you feel like it's the right thing to do. You're doing it to help other people. You know, you're doing it because then it's kind of like, you know, whatever you do is going to help somebody else, and then somebody else may feel that you've helped them, and then they'll, in turn, you know, help somebody else. And so we, you know, we see this so often, and that's some of the reasons why the NAACP, we, you know, we're nonprofit, but we raise funds for scholarships, and we donate scholarships in every year in January. At our Martin Luther King Jr. luncheon. And, you know, we don't have, a whole lot. Sometimes, we're out there looking for people to, you know, make donations because what we do with our scholarship funds is just try to help anybody that feels that, you know, they could need a little boost with financial assistance. And it's not just for African Americans, and neither is the NAACP, because how many in here, just by show of hands, thought the NAACP is only for African Americans? By show of hands. And so there's a lot of people that, you know, that think that it is only for African Americans, but, you know, it's not to everybody that can be a member of the NAACP. And so we, you know, we see that a lot. And some of the reasons why, when we see these movies like 12 Years a Slave, and we talk about education, because, you know, Solomon, you know, could read and write, and he was free. There were folks that were slaves. They were forbidden to learn how to read and write, so they didn't know how to read and write. They had to rely on whatever the master was telling them to do, because it wasn't the fact that, you know, that they had a choice. Just like Jenny had said, that she had a choice to be with Master Epps or not. She didn't have a choice. You know, when he had put Jenny in that house so he could be there, so she could be there for him when he would, you know, go over and see. And the his wife knew that he was, it wasn't, you wouldn't call it an affair. He wasn't having an affair with Jenny. You know, he was going over and being with Jenny whenever he felt that, you know, he wanted to. So those are some of the things that, you know, that we see, you know, when we talk about, you know, slavery and reparations, and so many people now, they'll say, well, I never would have been a slave. I wouldn't have been one. But as you could see in the movie and in the book, is that they had no choice. You know, they were slaves, and if they weren't, they were killed. And so in order to live, yes, they had to go out and do the work, obey the master. Even when the Master Epps said to Solomon, he didn't like the way he talked, because he said that he talked like he was uppity, and meaning he didn't talk like, you know, one of some of the other people that he thought that they should be, the, you know, maybe the fill hands and folks, because Solomon was educated. And so then when Solomon knew exactly what he was saying, and he changed the tone of his voice, as you can recall, and he started talking, yes, a master, you know, those type of things. And he said, okay, that's better. And so you know, see all of those type of things, and that's why, just kind of bringing back to the you know, the work of the NAACP, and why we stress so much for the need for education and the economic disparities that we see so often. And we see that when we talk about we'll say minorities and women, so white women aren't making as much money as the men. And then when we look at the wage disparities, then there's a huge gap. And what we're saying is that if a person has a job and they're the same job, regardless of woman or man, they should be making the same amount of money. And so you don't want to say, well, I'm going to go and get an education, I'm going to get a master's degree, and then you have a master's degree, and then a person that has no degree is making more money than you are, simply because he's a man. And so we don't believe that is fair. And, you know, we continue to, you know, fight for those type of causes all the time. And I know that I see the picture here of J.D. Williams. He was a good friend, and so he was just a very, very good person, and love to listen and talk with him all the time. And he was one of our speakers one year at our Martin Luther King Jr. luncheon too, and just a really great man. And so we, you know, appreciate all the work that he's done. And then I also know Tim Chambliss, that he's been around for a long time. I've known him for many, many years. We won't say how many years, but but he's been a really great, good person, inspiration to, you know, the works of the NAACP and the civil rights era, you know, different things that go on. And so when I say that there's work that you can do, there's so often a lot of volunteer work that you can do with just to, you know, make a difference. And With students, I know you probably often say that there's so little time that you don't really have time, but you'd be amazed how just a small amount of time could help a lot of people. And so we see that a lot. And so I'm really happy that you have taken the time to read the 12 Years a Slave and hopefully some other books and, similar to this. But then, ask those pertinent questions as, okay, that happened, so what next? What happened to Solomon's children way down the line? 12 years without the father. But it was good that they had a mother, Anne, who was a very strong woman in their lives. And then it was good that they had Henry, who was raised with Solomon, that was kind of like an overseer of the family. He's kind of always there to help him and everything. So it's always good because you have somebody else there that's always there to lend a helping hand that's gonna help. And then you may wonder, okay, what about the families of the people that sold Solomon into slave? Whatever happened, with them? How would they feel about that was my great-grandfather that did that, different things in guilt and so forth. But we're not here to blame, any one person or one group, because it was a group of people that made all of this happen. So when Hamilton and Merrill Brown were scheming, more or less, to sell Solomon, into slavery, they were doing it for money. They knew that Solomon didn't want to go, but then they persuaded him because they were telling him you can make a lot of money, and they knew that he needed the money, because he had a wife and three children. He couldn't get work being a carpenter, and so he thought, well, yes, I do play the fiddle very well, and people enjoy it so much that I could go and make some money, doing with that. So I think, it kind of brings into perspective of, some of the things that we see today is that, people are, looking for employment. They're looking for better wages, and they will continue to, we'll continue to do that. And so I'm going to just open it up if there might be any questions. I think there might be a microphone. Oh, okay.
All right, so is this on? Yeah, if anyone has any questions, just state your name and a little bit about yourself and ask your questions. So, we'll come up
here. My name's Josh. Is that working? Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name's Josh Greep. When we talk about what the agenda or the ability that the NAACP has to, in contrast to social welfare, what is it doing to help people with the mobility of a lower socioeconomic strata? What do we do? What is the NAACP? What role do they play outside the realm of just scholarships to help those people in that lower economic strata to rise?
Good question. The NAACP, we have at one of our offices in our headquarters, which we're headquartered in Baltimore, and we have offices in New York as well. We have what we call Economic Development Office, and we do not only scholarships, but then employment opportunities. We have the training opportunities where people can train, for different jobs, and we have workshops on the different training economic when we talk about economic development, and so we're doing all of those type of things like that to try to help people get into jobs and then have learning about the employment opportunities, helping people write their resumes, helping people do interviews for jobs, you know, and then just kind of helping them along that way. So there's some of those opportunities, but not, you know, not just the scholarships, but, you know, other ways that we try to help them gain employment.
Hi, I'm Jeff Dalby, a political science major. So kind of related to something you said earlier about people saying that they would never be a slave, I feel kind of in that same vein. I wouldn't have the control, the self-control to not just, you know, kill the master or something. And was that actually a concern? I mean, did people actually rise up in numbers that were significant, and were the slave owners concerned about that at this time frame?
Yes, yes. There were people that didn't want to be slaves, of course, and a lot of times what happened, they would just, you know, kill them. There's another movie that's just recently come out called The Butler. I don't know if some of you have seen that one. And they're working in the field, and the master calls the wife out and, you know, takes her to this, what they call a little shed, like. And the boy said, you know, Papa, you know, aren't you going to do anything? Because, you know, that was his mother. And so when the father tried to say something, just kind of, you know, kind of like wanted to just say something. He didn't say, I didn't like what you did. I mean, because that was the master. So he did, you know, kind of like, you know, call his master. And he looked at him and pulled his gun and shot him in the head, killed him. So there was a lot of times when the slaves said, you know, I'm just not going to do it. I'd rather be dead. And they end up, you know, killing them. And so we saw that a lot.
Hi, my name is Jimmy Gama, major in political science here in University of Utah. Thanks for coming. It is grateful that we have you here. I just kind of concerned about the story of Solomon and his wife and the three children. It was a tragic, and I think was very shocking to me to learn about that. But apart from the story of Solomon, is the slavery in, you know, I'm not been here from those 1800 years, but I just wanted to make sure that you understand the whole thing. The story of slavery seems to be like more is in a black kind. Was there any other slaves that were also inclusive, probably maybe in the story, or maybe also become part of all this difficult time that other blacks have been through it? Is there any color apart from the blacks that have been as part of this story of slavery, or is only a black thing, slavery? Thank you.
Okay. Well, it was mostly, you know, from this perspective, was the slaveries when they were sold and brought over, you know, from Africa, into slaves. And so in this part here, it, you know, it's mostly just the, you know, the black people. But there was other people, you know, that you read about, but they weren't enslaved as the way that blacks were slaves and worked for free labor. So you didn't see that. You saw where, like for the Indian, American Indians, and where the white man came in and got, you know, just took their land. But that was different. You know, it was a different type of control. And so all of it, I think, is more or less what you would consider, you know, control and power over other people.
Hi, I'm Aline, and I'm a student here at the U, and I'm going to bring us back to the current. I have a question about the NAACP. I'm just curious what resources they are putting towards the current battle of Kitchen v. Herbert that's headed to the Supreme Court, what resources the NAACP is supplying for that.
Exactly. Well, thanks for asking that as well. There's several things that the NAACP we're working on. Before the NAACP can sign on with the courts, you know, we have to get permission from our national. And I was at our annual meeting two weeks ago, in fact, and met with our attorneys and met with our interim president, Lorraine Miller, asking that we would they would consider and allow us to sign on a brief, you know, with the court. And so we have been granted that permission to do that. So that's one of the huge things. I mean, that's a huge thing to have the NAACP name on the brief in this particular instance, you know, because it is, we've been working all along. We support the marriage equality, and we wanted to make sure that the NAACP name was out there as well, on the forefront, trying to make a difference in what's been going on. And so they're working on the final wordings now, and I may even have that final wordings even today. And once we do that, then we'll have a press conference and try to put all of that information forward.
Well, I have a question, if you don't mind.
Yes.
So there's this debate going on right now if we've moved into a post-racial society. Do you think we've reached that point in society, or do you think there's still work to go until we can actually deem our current status as post-racial?
I think there's a lot of work to do, and you know, especially when you talk about the post-racial, because right now, just like when she asked the question about, you know, the marriage equality, and what was it yesterday? I think it was in Kentucky. You know, they said that they'll accept the. There's been so many, even just this week, going on. So in Kentucky, they said that they would accept marriage between anybody LGBT in from any state. Then Nevada, just about a week or so ago, said that they weren't going to fight that one anymore. North Carolina said they were going to fight. So, you know, when you're talking about passing through being post-racial, you know, there's so much work to do there, but then there's still a lot of work to do, you know, when we're talking about, you know, all of the marriage equality, the things that's going on, and the very so many negative things that are being said. You know, when you see it on, I see it when I'm reading a lot of articles or going through the newspaper articles or people, you know, their nasty tweets and things. So, you know, we still have a way that goes all the way around. You know, post-racial society, talking about, you know, marriage equality and all of those type of things. You would have thought that by now, here it is 2014, that we would have been maybe a lot further ahead than what we are. The Supreme Court just last year struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act. You know, so we're having to go back and refight some of those battles. Some of the things that the NAACP did with our marches, now LGBT groups are doing the same thing. NAACP is trying to help, you know, in those efforts. And so it's, you know, we're just kind of going back sometime, which is sad.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Dr. Brian Hodgkins, I'm a faculty member on campus. So in part, I feel like the NAACP is my parents' organization, in a sense. And so when I work with black males through my fraternity, and so there's a lot of discussions going on about what can youth do to be involved and be activists, not necessarily just on campus, but throughout the city. And so what does the NAACP locally have to offer for youth of color who want to be involved and want to create change in the city?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that. We're not only an organization for, you know, youth of color, but for everybody that would want to be involved in NAACP. We have a Salt Lake Youth Council, and that's up to age 25. And then we also have a University of Utah College chapter. So like everybody in here can be a member of that. And that started when President Bernie Manchin was here. And I approached him and asked him about, you know, can we start a college chapter here? Because they have college chapters all across the country. And he was very, very supportive and said yes. And so we do have a college chapter University of Utah College Chapter, and everybody in this room can be a member of that. So there's a lot of different activities, you know, within the NAACP that the NAACP do promote, other than, like, voter registration is one huge one that we do. We also talk about the, like, tutoring. You know, if you have somebody that you can tutor with, say, for instance, college students can tutor to the college students can tutor to the youth council students. We have a large number of our students as well, our youth council, that are members of the Boys and Girls Clubs. And so they, you know, we have just different areas, just community in community, involved in the community, involved in the different churches, you know, those type of things. So if anybody would want to be involved, they can call our local NAACP number, and we can, you know, connect you with our folks. And even here on University of Utah, I'd be more than happy to help, because as a state conference president, that's my job as well, is to kind of help pull all these different groups together, youth council, college chapters, and the adult ones. Does that answer your question? You're welcome.
Cool. Jeff, I'm back. So another question. I feel that myself and a lot of people in my same age group, things like racism, just they seem so foreign, like it's not really something that I even notice as far as like race or gender or something. But I do see a lot of times in the media, there's a lot of like, you know, a white person shot a black person, so it's racism. Do you think the media actually is doing a decent portrayal of how these things happen, or is it blowing things out of proportion?
No. They're not blowing out of proportion, because there's a couple of them that I can talk about that I'm sure you know, the Trayvon Martin, and people were really shocked when, you know, there was a not guilty verdict. And then most recently, a mistrial for Jordan Davis. And there was another young Florida young man. He was only like 17 years old. Music was playing loud. The white man comes and has an argument, tells him to turn the music down. He gets the gun out. He fires like 10 bullets into the car, the vehicle, drives off, goes back home like 2 hours drive, orders pizza, you know, and not even call the police to say, yeah, that was me, I did that shooting, I don't know if I shot and killed anybody or not. And then all of a sudden, you know, you go to court, you go to the trial, and you listen to it, and you think that there's no way that they'll find, you know, not find him guilty of anything. But he was found guilty on the three attempted was shooting into the car vehicle, but not guilty of actual killing the young man. So I think what the media is doing, and I am really glad that they're out there, and because they're showing us all of the different things that's going on, and the stand your ground. So one of the things that the NAACP has done, two, is trying to work with the legislators in different states to abolish the stand your ground laws that they have. There's a portion of the stand your ground law in the state of Utah. So we're very sensitive on those different issues.
My name is Joshua Castro. I'm an undergraduate student. So there are people who say that slavery is like decades ago, it's past, that we shouldn't dwell on it. But do you think slavery should still be an issue to be considered in making policies? Should it be a factor in making decisions for policymakers?
Should slavery be an issue?
Should they use it to make decisions for policies?
Say, for instance, like, and I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but say, for instance, like reparations. Should they? Is that what you're kind of referencing to? If they can look back and say that, what is it that we can do, you know, because of slavery, to kind of make things right for all of the ancestors? that they would have to look at slavery in that sense.
Thank you again. I still have a concern again. My question here is, if you are asked to grade from time of slavery to until to this time that African Americans or blacks are today, what percentage you could give as a fair grade that is from slavery to inequality to racism as of the current?
Okay, if I was going to give a grade to
the changes
to
that,
the U.S.
Uh-huh.
To the United States on how well
how
it's done.
Yes, how well they handled slavery and how good the slaves or people have achieved from that, how much grade you can give as of the current so we can know that there is changes or not from slavery.
That might be a kind of a difficult one to say because there's been a lot of progress, but then there's still things that needs to be done. So if I say, maybe like a B into, you know, these are some of the things that has, you know, we've seen the Voting Rights Act, we've seen, you know, the Civil Rights Act, we've seen the Brown v. Board of Education, we've seen so many different types of progress that's been made, and progress that, you know, that continues to be made. And so, you know, there's still, you know, hope out there. We have, a large number of, you know, Congress people. We only have one black senator that's even elected here, you know, in the U.S., just one black senator. And so we there's still a lot of progress that needs to be made, but it takes everybody to kind of make a difference and try to, you know, do some things. And so hopefully we'll see more. But one of the things that going back to the Voting Rights Act, for instance, what the NAACP is doing is trying to work with Sinsenberg and some of the other senators and Congress folks, asking them to co-sponsor the Civil Rights Act amendment, because then so we can kind of put some teeth back into the parts 4 and 5, section 4 and 5 of the Civil Rights Act. So, that's one of the things that we're working on. So we'll see how many people, and it's a bipartisan legislation, so we'll kind of see how many people will just kind of say yes that they would do it. But you'd be surprised at how many people that legislators won't sign on to be even a sponsor, and some will even be co-sponsors. They'll just wait on the sidelines just to see what happens. Kind of a wait-and-see attitude.
So with all the great things that the NAACP does for in so many different ways, where does the funding come from? Is it tax money? Are these private sponsors? Is it a kind of a mix?
No, our funding, and which the funding through our national, some of the large corporations will make donations through the national. But on the local level, you know, we have to rely on, you know, businesses, sometimes law firms, you know, to make donations to the NAACP. Even when they do make donations to the NAACP, and they may say, well, we want this part to go for scholarships, and we segregate that part to be just used for scholarships. But we still have to be accountable for every penny, you know, to the penny, to our national. We do like a financial reports after each event. We do a year-end financial report. So we, you know, we always have to be accountable for all that we do.
And sorry, just to further, I don't understand a little bit more. Do you ever feel pressure from those sponsors? Have you ever felt an agenda pushed on the NAACP? Has that become a conflict ever?
No, okay. not at all. Because they can be a even what we call a life member a business corporation can be a life member. But if they're doing any type of discrimination against anybody, then, you know, we'll tell them now, you know, because you are affiliated with the NAACP as a corporate life member, you know better. You know not to do this, you know, discrimination like this. And so, no, NAACP will come down on them as hard as we do the others.
Does anyone have any other questions?
Aaron Height, I'm a student here. I had a question about something you said earlier about the Supreme Court taking away previous rights that had already been established. So my question just was specifically what those privileges or, I guess, rights that were taken away that you're fighting for already again?
Okay, part of that, what I was referring to was the Voting Rights Act. And because in, like around 2009, we had the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, and we had full support of Congress. And then in last year, you know, because it was it had gone to the Supreme Court on the Voting Rights Act, and they struck down, you know, parts 4 and 5, which it was said that, you know, some of the states in the South where they had all of the different laws that years ago is like how many, you know, marbles in a bottle, you know, so blacks couldn't vote. Don't know how many, you know, the different things like that. So they told poll taxes and things. So what they did with that was saying that there's complete change in the country now. And those states, there's no need to kind of have a watch over them. So they don't have to come before, you know, ask for permission to change some of their laws for voting. And so then that's why all of a sudden you saw after the Supreme Court made their decision, some of the states were changing their laws and being discriminatory. And that's when Attorney General Eric Holder came back and said to those states that, no, you're not going to do that. So he didn't allow that to happen. So, like, the Voting Rights Act is one of those.
Sorry, you're probably sick of me by now. So these states in question, I know that they that there's kind of a something I see anyway, that the Republican Party is not very nice in regards to almost anything, but especially race and whatnot. So I'm wondering if this discriminatory laws, do you think they're designed to prevent, like, African Americans from voting, or is it just trying to stop Democrats from, like, Democrats in general making it to the polls?
No, I think it's more, it seems like it's more geared toward African American, because there was different things where they had African Americans, they did, you know, for the early voting, and that was always good because everybody can't get to the polls at the same time, same day, one day, and they had it where what they call take your souls to the polls on Sunday, and when I got to church, they would go, and this was mostly in the African American communities, and they would go to you know, go to vote, and so Florida was one of the ones that they just said, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, and they were closing some of the polling places where mostly African Americans were going to vote. So Florida is one place where the NAACP has had a lot of on-ground interaction with.
Hello, my name is Marianne Kingston. What is one thing we as a community to do to make a difference and to change, like, the discrimination laws?
You said, what is it?
What is one thing we as a community could do for just to change it?
You know, there's, you know, I think what community folks can do, you know, to change discriminatory things that you see is to be able to join in with other groups, you know, be able to help them in any kind of way. For instance, the issue with marriage equality right now, being able to, at least if you can't be able to sign on, you know, with a brief, NAACP, you can always, you know, write letters to the editor, You can have a small group that I know with NAACP we can't join in a rally. We can't call it a rally without having the approval first from our national. And so we're very streamlined in the things that we can do and can't do. So, you know, some of the things like that to help. Voter registration, you know, I keep talking about that. So, you know, there's different things that you can do. You know, we have different committees, for instance, even with the University of Utah for the college chapter. There's the health, there will be like the health committee, there will be economic development. There's different things that you can always do to be involved. And the main thing is just to be involved.
Thank you so much for being here today. I necessarily don't have a question, but I have a comment if I can expound on what this gentleman said in regards to racism and how it's kind of played out in the media. And one thing that brought to mind was the difference between overt racism and covert racism. And I also think it's this idea of being young or kind of being in a very isolated place. You may not always see what deemed for many people of color who see racism every day. And so oftentimes that could be institutionalized and it looks very different to very different people. But I also think it's a thing of privilege that allows you not to see some of that racism and kind of where you're planted at. And so when the young lady asked, what can you do? I think it's having this awareness that just because it's not happening to you doesn't necessarily mean that it's not happening, and learning how to validate individual stories when those things are happening without saying, oh, I think you're just taking it the wrong way, or maybe they meant it like this, you know. And so being mindful of the language that we use when someone is talking with you about maybe what they perceived or very much in their real lives is a racism, or they've have like had someone with a, you know, a situation where racism was had for them as well too.
Exactly. And that is so true. Thank you.
Jeanette, thank you so very much for speaking to us. Tim Chambliss,
yes.
Briefly, if President Obama was standing here today with us, what would you like to hear from him with regard to maybe efforts at moral suasion or executive orders to be able to really bring about a fulfillment of civil rights?
I think one of the executive orders would be to put teeth back into the Voting Rights Act. And I'd say, you know, Mr. President, would you do that so we're not having to call all the different Congress folks? For instance, I'm over Idaho, Nevada, and Utah, so and sending letters to and emails and telephone calls to all of them. And I heard from one that was in Nevada, and it wasn't very positive. So I would say to ask him to put strength back in the Voting Rights Act. And another thing would be what he did just yesterday, because he is a president, we know, for all the people. And it is the first time that we have even known to have a person of color that's in the White House. And what he did yesterday was saying that, you know, he was raised, you know, without a father. Of course, he had his grandfather who raised him. And but he was saying there were some things that he did that, you know, he wasn't proud of. But now he wants to try to see all of these young boys that he sees being targeted and killed and all of the killings that's happening in Chicago of African-American young boys, that to say to them, you know, what can we do to make things better so that, you know, they're not getting out there being victims of, you know, homicides across the country. So I think we see that too. So that was a good thing that he did yesterday, because I think everybody was happy to see him do that because they're so often saying, you know, well, what is the president doing for the black community? And a lot of times, you know, we have to say, well, you know, he is a president for all the people, so we can't just have him do, you know, saying, well, this is just for the African-American community. But, you know, it kind of helps when, you know, we see that, you know, as I think somebody said earlier, you know, you've been there, you've walked in those footsteps, so you know what to do and how to make things better. And even if you haven't walked in those footsteps and you see some of the things that happen, then you know the things that are wrong and you know the things that are right, and you can try to right those wrongs.
Please join me in thanking our guest.